Now, Sandy.
Ned was looking at Phil. The boy's face was calm enough, but I sensed rejection in his gaze, and I think Phil sensed it too. He sighed, folded his arms across his chest, and looked down as if to say he was done talking. His testimony was finished. Ned turned to me. What happened that night when you dissected the bat? He kept calling it a bat, and it hadn't been a bat. That was just a word I'd used, what Curtis would have called a nail to hang my hat on. And all at once I was mad at him. More than mad. Pissed like a bear. And I was also angry at myself for feeling that way, for daring to feel that way. You see, mostly what I was angry at was the kid raising his head, raising his eyes to mine, asking his questions, making his foolish assumptions, one of which happened to be that when I said bat, I meant bat, and not some unspeakable, indescribable thing that crept out of a crack in the floor of the universe and then died. But mostly it was him raising his head and his eyes. I know that doesn't exactly make me out to be the prince of the world, but I'm not going to lie about it. Up until then, what I'd mostly felt was sorry for him. Everything I'd done since he started showing up at the barracks had been based on that comfortable pity. Because all the time when he'd been washing windows and raking leaves and snow blowing his way through the drifts in the back parking lot, all that time he'd kept his head down, meekly down. You didn't have to contend with his eyes. You didn't have to ask yourself any questions, because pity is comfortable, isn't it? Pity puts you right up on top. Now he had lifted his head. He was using my own words back at me, and there was nothing meek in his eyes. He thought he had a right, and that made me mad. He thought I had a responsibility, that what was being said out here wasn't a gift being given, but a debt being repaid, and that made me madder. That he was right made me maddest of all. I felt like shoving the heel of my hand up into the shelf of his chin and knocking him spang off the bench. He thought he had a right, and I wanted to make him sorry. Our feelings toward the young never much change in this regard, I suppose. I don't have kids of my own. I've never been married. Like Shirley, I guess I married Troop D. But I've got plenty of experience when it comes to the young, both inside and outside the barracks. I've had them in my face plenty of times. It seems to me that when we can no longer pity them, when they reject our pity, not with indignation but with impatience, we pity ourselves instead. We want to know where they went, our comfy little ones, our baby buntings. Didn't we give them piano lessons and show them how to throw the curveball? Didn't we read them Where the Wild Things Are and help them search for Waldo? How dare they raise their eyes to ours and ask their rash and stupid questions? How dare they want more than we want to give? Sandy, what happened when you guys dissected the... Not what you want to hear, I said. And when his eyes widened a little at the coldness he heard in my voice, I was not exactly displeased. Not what your father wanted to see, or Tony either. Not some answer. There never was an answer. Everything to do with the Buick was a shimmer mirage, like the ones you see on I-87 when it's hot and bright. Except that's not quite true either. If it had been, I think we could have dismissed the Buick eventually. The way you dismiss a murder when 6 months go by and you all just kind of realize you're not going to catch whoever did it, that the guy's going to slide. With the Buick and the things that came out of the Buick, there was always something you could catch hold of. Something you could touch or hear. Or something you could